This is the First Time Podcast,
where we talk writing, publishing, and all of the feels.
It's conversations between us
and conversations with Australian and international authors about their craft, their books, and the writing life. I'm Kate Mildenhall.
And I'm Catherine Collette. Welcome to the First Time Podcast, Season 6. This podcast was recorded and produced on the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri and Wurrung people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to their elders past and present and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander cultures.
Good morning, Catherine Collette.
Good morning. I've just ranted to you. I feel like I've just dumped. What do they say? Dumped out.
That's okay. This is what we're here for. And we're sorry, listeners, that you don't get to hear the rant that normally happens before we start talking. We'll do that one day.
I think we already have done it, though, haven't we?
We did it accidentally once.
Oh, God.
A dear, dear listener messaged us to say, you've uploaded everything. Oh dear, we're nothing if not awkward and real. Catherine Collette, this morning is an exciting morning because you have some news. Can you please share with me and our first time listening family your news?
Okay, so after what feels like the most epic amount of time spent waiting, I can officially say that my middle grade manuscript, currently titled Shellsville, I don't know if that's going to change, is going to be published. Yay!
Oh, it's so good. I'm so excited for this book. I'm so excited for the whole series. Tell me, or tell the listeners, because I know what you did. Tell the listeners about what happened when you got that offer, when you found out.
I can't remember.
You just got really excited and then you went out and took the family out for dinner.
Oh, yeah, that's what we did. Yes. Sorry, I thought maybe I'd recorded it somewhere. I got really, really excited and we went out for dinner that night and had a celebration dinner at, where did we go? A pub in Fitzroy. It was really good. You have to celebrate the highs, right?
You have to celebrate the highs.
The waiting had been so long and I messaged you a couple of times say, yeah, you really, whatever confidence you start out with, the act of waiting can very quickly erode it. And you had said, hold your nerve, just
hold
like, let it unravel.
Nerve. Hold your nerve. That is so exciting. And also because you are now, you have done the thing. You are crossing the divide. You are going to be both an adult fiction writer and a children's author and illustrator. And I'm so here for this, Collette.
Yeah, I'm excited. Really
okay, other things. Not quite as exciting, but also exciting. How did your Toastmasters presentations go?
It was good. It was really fun. So I had one on a Tuesday night and then I had a Saturday morning and a Sunday morning. The Sunday morning were at the district conference. So the district goes from, I think, most of Sydney to Canberra to Wollongong. It was in Campbell Field or Campbell Town, one of the Campbells. Yeah, really fun. When the book came out in February 2022, I'd been on the radio when I was in Sydney, and I'm pretty sure that this was the first day the book had come out. I was on Talkback, and so they had people. It was like talking about a book about public speaking and Toastmasters, and a bunch of Toastmasters had called in. And at the conference, I had multiple people come up and say, "I heard that segment," and then I went out and bought the book. So that was really nice.
How much? How reflective of the conference that is in the book was this particular conference?
They're definitely echoes. So probably the book is exaggerated, but there was a particular moment I thought could have gone in the book. They had a council meeting from the first day of the conference from like 9 a.m. I think it was meant to finish at 10:30 and my speech was at 11. And the council meeting was a lot of motion moving, debating various changes and electing new officials and all that sort of stuff. So pretty, you could argue, a little bit drier in content than other aspects of the conference, but it went so wildly over time that, and it was in a massive room too, that a lot of people that were involved in that missed the most of my session because they were still in there. But people kept coming out, people that were sort of either helping me or organizers, and sort of really mostly complaining about how slow it was going and how long it was taking. So it's sort of a felt like a meta moment in some ways.
Oh, that is such a joy.
But you could, if you ever have the opportunity, you could not ask for a more lovely and more appreciative audience. Yeah.
Amazing. We also had the great joy of ending up in the same city at the same time, which was quite hilarious because it was unplanned. And we got to catch up with a bunch of amazing Sydney writers, which was super, super fun.
So good. So much fun. I do reckon, and I've now adjusted my Instagram profile, I think people should put what city they come from in their Instagram or similar profiles. Ooh. Because I was thinking when I was going up, I was like, oh, I should try and meet up with different authors and people that I've, you know, interacted with even in some small way. But I didn't really know where many, like some people I definitely knew where that they were Sydney based, yeah. But others I was like, I have no idea.
How funny. And because you and I had both like separately contacted different gangs because of the times that we had and various things, because I didn't have very long because I was doing publisher thing. And it was great because there were people there who hadn't met each other yet.
Yeah. So it was really, like really
bringing
nice.
People together. And I did think too about that first time, and you ended up having a work commitment, so you couldn't come that first time that we took the podcast.
I know, I'm still annoyed that I couldn't get there for
Anna Downs and Petronella McGovern, who we saw the other night, were both there at that event. That's the first time I met them. And it was just so glorious. And I can really remember feeling like, I don't know anyone in Sydney. Like I don't know writers in Sydney. I don't know where they gather. and it was so lovely to be able to catch up with. So shout out to all those incredible women who we met.
We also thrillingly met at 4 o'clock on a Wednesday afternoon. Oh. You had to leave at, I think, 6 or 10 to 6 or something because.
And let's not talk about what time I got home.
I know. Well, at the other end of the spectrum. So you left at like 6 to go and do a dinner thing. A few of us went then for dinner at 6 in Darling Harbour. The dinner finished at, say, 8. And a few of the, I think Petronella, who's Sydney-based, was like, oh, you know, you, Catherine, Megan, Jane, you know, you're up from Melbourne. You guys should go out now. This is at 8 o'clock. Oh, my God. That was never going to happen. Like, The pure joy of having been out, seen people, had a lot of fun, had dinner, and it only being 8 o'clock, unparalleled.
The joy here is one of the many ways in which you and I differ, Catherine, because I had actually managed a hotel nap, a 1 hour just exquisite nap in between the things that I'd had to do already that day. Although, yes, as mentioned, probably should have got home from the publisher dinner earlier than 2 a.m., which is when I did get back. And I'm making, you know what it actually helped me with though? I did realize then, because obviously at the moment where there's all very exciting working on the tour for the Hummingbird Effect in August and September. And I did realize that I cannot be the last woman standing at every event at every city I go
to. Why not? If you have that in you,
no, but I don't have it in me like multiple evenings in 1 week and for 2 months running. I can't. So
can you reveal anything about the tour?
Can I reveal anything about the tour? What can I reveal? The book's out on August 2nd. I'll be going to lots of places, and first-time podcast people will be first to know where those places are. It's all fitting
okay,
in.
This I'm is doing, a non-reveal. I'll be
this
going
is a non-reveal.
Lots of
sorry,
places.
I will yeah. say that one of the most exciting things is that in September, we are doing a little kind of regional tour of Southern New South Wales. So if you're a bookstore or a reader in Southern New South Wales, do let me know, because it's in the school holidays. So I'm taking the kids and my mum and dad, my bless. Partner can't get time off work. And we're doing like, you know, cabin stays Maruya. And going to visit a lot.
Like that south coast of New South Wales?
Yeah. Maruya is on the list. So that's really funny ace. And fun. And I'm really excited about that. My youngest is going to be my publicist and manager, and she is very excited about being in charge of such a thing. So that's pretty
fun. What is it about youngests that have that vibe?
don't know. Yeah. I don't know. But yeah, so that's, yeah. So things coming. I've been getting a bit angsty because there's so many amazing cover reveals coming out for books that are coming out after mine. I'm like, guys, where's my cover? But it's coming. It's coming because you kind of can't do anything until that's up and out. So that is coming very soon.
I do love Ultimo Press's approach to cover reveals. If you follow Ultimo on Instagram, they do a great cover reveal thing where they'll have a black form looking tile that says, this is the first time you'll ever see this cover.
Yeah.
And the next slide on the carousel is the cover. I really like that approach.
I wonder if that does something to the algorithm because you stay longer because you swipe. I wonder. We'll have to ask someone from Ultimo. I just think anything that
introduces an element of surprise is doubly.
Totally.
Yeah, doubly totally. Cool.
I have something to talk about. This week, the ASA in their newsletter released some findings from a survey they did with authors and illustrators about their feelings about AI. Now, obviously,
interesting.
I have been thinking, reading, using AI a lot because it is something that I explore in The Hummingbird Effect in the new book. And also just because it's incredibly interesting right now. So the respondents, so there were 208 responses to the survey in total, and the ASA says, and I quote, the most striking immediate insights are the respondents support transparency, so that AI-generated works should be identified as such. And the respondents believe that authors or illustrators should be compensated and credited for the use of their work in training generative AI. So that idea, for people who are not all across that, is that anything we put into an AI when we're chatting with it, so if you're chatting with ChatGPT, your data is going into it. That's one way in which these things happen, but also that the data sets, the incredibly big data sets that are used to train any AI, you know, these respondents are saying, well, if my work is in there, then that should be compensated as well. So this is an ongoing kind of idea. And it's interesting, 80% of the respondents said that they don't use generative AI at all as part of their writing or illustrating process. And then the remaining said, yeah, we, you know, use it for brainstorming, et cetera, et cetera. So interesting. I wanted to ask you, are you using ChatGPT? Are you using it for work? Are you using it for your writing? Are you using any other kind of AI at the moment? And how do you feel about all of this?
Well, currently not. Carney keeps saying to me, oh, you should use AI to help you. And so a couple of times he's sort of done things and shown me to illustrate the potential power. One that he put in was, can you write me the start of a novel, however many words they generate in the start, that is like Harry Potter but includes the names Catherine and Carney. So it immediately then comes up, and then you can refine it and say, actually, we want it to be like way darker or way, you know, whatever that looks like. I mean, it was, as a thing to read, not particularly interesting, but as a thing to see how something works, pretty fascinating. When I was at the Toastmasters conference, someone was saying that someone in their club had given a speech. And so they did the whole speech, whatever the topic of the speech was, and then at the end said this whole speech was generated by AI and kind of critiqued themselves and the speech that they'd given and said what they would change. Yeah, I don't know. To me, I have this just urge to bury my head in the sand because I'm worried robots will take over the world.
Yeah.
Not the answer. I do think it's really interesting that people like Elon Musk are saying we almost need a 6-month moratorium to actually pause and think. If someone like him is saying that, I think that's pretty profound.
Yeah. Yeah. It's you know, it's crazy because I wrote about it and used it, like I've got Google alerts and stuff. Like I can't even keep up with all the think pieces and articles and essays and the extraordinary stuff being written about it. What I thought was interesting is this idea, because I have used, I've got an algorithm in the book, and I, you know, had written it all before I started using ChatGPT, and then I was, a lot of my conversations with ChatGPT were about the way it works and is built and, you know, the kind of philosophy and biases that are inherent in it and how it does certain things, because I was asking it, you know, pretty big questions about you know, how to fix the world or destroy the world, which of course it can't tell you how to destroy the world. It's not allowed to, you know, tell you to harm things at this point. The ChatGPT can't, but this is the problem, right? Someone else, some other AI could. But because in the end, in editing, we decided that I would use actual AI generated text as part of this algorithm, which is a very small part of the text, but it's there all the same. That this idea about referencing its use, so we've actually got it on the imprint page, that part of this novel has been generated using AI, specifically ChatGPT. And again, like you're saying, from the person from Toastmasters, part of it, partly it's a provocation, you know, partly it's so that we can talk about it. And that's the point of it in the novel. But yeah, so, so interesting. And
well, it's a space, I think, and maybe it's less AI, but that idea of use of, and maybe it exists in fiction, use of AI or computers for friendship.
Yeah.
Which is sort of has this ethical and kind of sad layer to it. But if you were very isolated and got joy out of a friendship with someone that didn't, that wasn't human or didn't exist, is that okay?
Well, there is so much to discuss.
But yeah,
and also that it's really different. And this is why it's so interesting seeing these responses for the ASA survey, is that it's really interesting the way that it is hitting and the concerns in different industries. So, you know, my friends who work in copywriting and publicity and things like that, like, our jobs are going to be gone soon. Like, it's just, you know, there'll just be enormous loss of jobs. Or my friends who are in education and are having to work at university level, trying to work out if this essay was written by AI or not. Just really different to how creatives are approaching it as well. So anyway, we shall talk more about that, but that was interesting. And in fact, my first read to recommend is on this topic, Tracy Spicer's new book called Man Made, which is all about AI and about, in particular, the inherent and inbuilt biases that exist within it because of the data it's trained on. So the gender bias, age bias, there's so much that's built into it. Extraordinary read. Is it
nonfiction or fiction?
It's nonfiction. Yeah, nonfiction. Yeah. So it's, I mean, you can just see her work as a journalist. Like, it's so in depth. She covers everything, but also in that incredibly accessible way that in which she writes, so that it's just like, yeah, easy, I can get this. It's terrifying. Lots of the blurbs on it say, you know, this is an urgent and terrifying book, and it is in lots of ways. But also, you know, you've got to know what's going on, right, to be able to talk about it and be involved in the conversation. So I really recommend that. People have a look at it. Also have a look at the stuff that Tracy's putting up, you know, online on Instagram and things like that, just some of the questions and the ideas. And also she's posting lots of other organizations which are kind of working specifically to try and address this, these biases that are inherent in the training data. So yeah, super interesting.
You ever think, very interesting, like, maybe we should just turn off electricity and, like,
I do. I think a lot about that.
Such a childish response.
No, I think a lot about that. Yeah. Yeah, I do. Can't wait till you read the book, Catherine.
A kind of a left field recommendation. It is for a newsletter by Brendan Leonard. I think the newsletter is called Semirad, or his website is called Semirad. Brendan Leonard is not someone I was familiar with, but came to through one of the New Yorker cartoon Instagram accounts. He's written a book called Make It, 50 Myths and Truths About Creating. But what he's done in the lead up to publication of that book, is this thing that he's calling a pop-up newsletter. So you sign up. It started on the 15th of May. So if listeners are signing up now, it'll be a week in. It doesn't restart. So the content isn't on a landing page either, so far as I can tell. But basically, he takes this book that has these 50 myths and truths, and he says, sign up for this newsletter. The newsletter will go for 25 days, and it has 25 of the, and it's illustrated, so like cartoony kind of look to it. For 25 days in a row, you'll get 25 of these 50 myths and truths. So it's a little micro essay about creativity and about writing and comic stuff, but it's just a cool idea. It works very well for his book because it's sort of arts based and you can break bits off. It's nonfiction. But I guess the idea at the end of it is that you would be engaged enough to then go out and buy his book. I just love this idea of a pop-up newsletter, mm-hmm. particularly in the lead up to a book coming out. I think there's something in that that people could really use. And there's also the idea that once you have that pop-up newsletter, there's nothing to say you can't package that as a 25-day kind of, people talk about giving away freebies as a way to get people to sign up to newsletters. You could really reuse it. And so a person signs up and it just starts the next day, that kind of thing.
That's very cool.
Cool idea.
I like that idea. I will be looking that up.
Yeah.
I have two other books that I want to recommend. The first one is kind of an admission of sorts that I have only just read my first ever Robbie Arnott book, Limber Lost, which is his latest one and which has just been nominated for the Miles Franklin along with about a bazillion other awards. I really loved it. It's a beautiful book and I imagine it's very telling.
First one, incredible, you completely unique.
Yes, just a beautiful language and imagery and very delightful. I did meet Robbie in Newcastle and delightful bloke, and that was partly why I put it to the top of my list. It is interesting, and we were talking about this just before we started recording, that so many books, though, if we're not reading them for the podcast or I'm not launching them or they're not written by a friend or they skip down the TBR pile. So you can get to this year and I go, yeah. I have not yet read any of Robbie's books. So yeah, just a reminder to myself to go back and to look at all those books, A, the ones on the shelf and B, the ones on lists that I haven't got to before, because I really love that. And the other one, which I am currently reading, another Tassie author actually, is Maggie McKellar's new book, Graft, which is a memoir. And oh my goodness, it is so good. I have talked before about Maggie McKellar's newsletter, The Sit Spot, which is just beautiful. She writes exquisitely, like the kind of writing that just every sentence you can tell has been worked on, thought about, weighed, you know, checked
her
again.
Newsletter is the same too,
exactly,
has
just
the
beautiful
same punch.
And I remember I actually met Maggie in one of Sarah Centilli's word caves, and I remember the first time that she spoke or read something out, just having that moment. And I think the only other time I've ever had it is in a class with you at RMIT, the first time that Emily Clements read out something that she
I wasn't
just written
in that
in class,
but I have heard about her reading piece that was generated within class.
Within the class.
Sort of
and
5 minutes
remember,
previous.
Yeah, my kind of jaw dropping and going, how does someone just articulate themselves like that so beautifully, so quickly? I so recommend it. It's a little hardcover, and it's a memoir of kind of life on the land. She farms down in Tassie. So it's got that aspect to it. It's got some illustrations in it. It's got notes about birds. It's also, essays about her life and what's happening. It references the drought and the animals there. It is superb, be a beautiful gift. It really reminded me of Vicky Hastrich's Night Fishing as well, which I read and loved a couple of years back and I often go back to. Just very exquisite writing. If you need some sentence inspiration, I would highly recommend. And the other thing that I read was Michelle Pratt's new thriller, Outback thriller, Rush, which is our featured segment today. Today, our featured book segment is brought to you by Simon & Schuster, and I'm very excited to be talking to Michelle Prack about her psychological thriller, The Rush. Michelle Prack is a professional communicator with a 30-year career in corporate communication, social media, politics, and journalism. Writing has been the backbone of much of her work, and she's written several short stories and self-published commercial women's fiction titles. She lives in Adelaide, lectures in public relations and social media at the University of South Australia. The Rush is her first thriller and what we're going to talk about today. Welcome, Michelle, to the First Time Podcast.
Thank you. I'm so excited to be here. Yeah, I've been listening since season one, so I feel like alumni in some way.
You're definitely alumni. We're very excited to have you. Well, you will know then, Michelle, that our kind of test for our featured guests is to get them to pitch straight off. So can you please give us the pitch for The Rush?
Absolutely. The Rush is an outback thriller. It centres on a road trip with four young people in the car. They're travelling down the centre of Australia from Adelaide to Darwin. They are two Adelaide University students and two international backpackers. And as they set out, they realise they're heading into flooded territory, which they didn't expect. At the same time, there's a remote outback pub called the Pindery, which they're keen on visiting, and the hoteliers Andrea and her husband Matt are sandbagging in preparation for that storm. But Matt's calling away to help a neighbour who's experiencing flooding, and that leaves Andrea and their toddler son alone. Eventually, everyone converges on the Pindery.
It is a very scary book to read. I posted that I was taking away on my camping trip and you delightfully DM'd me and said, are you serious? You're going to take it camping? And it was a good warning because it's got all the stuff I would expect of an outback thriller. The crazy weather, the backpackers, this ominous, terrifying vibe. Tell us, where did the seed come from?
The seed came from a lot of my own road trips and being a person who does have a bit of a paranoid and fraidy cat mind. And so I've taken a lot of outback and remote trips, mostly through previous gigs I've had. So, for example, I was chief of staff for a federal MP and his electorate took in 92% of SA, South Australia. So I had a lot of remote road trips. And, you know, going back and forth between Adelaide and places where my family live. And that always percolated in my mind, especially when I was in a more remote location where mobile phone coverage dropped out. So that's always interesting. And, you know, it's such a long distance between seeing any buildings or another car. So that just percolated in my mind and I knew it would be a great setting for a thriller.
I'm interested. I think I asked Anna Snookstra this question as well when I was talking to her about her outback thriller. If you ask someone who is naturally a little scared, what does it take you to get into the position where you're in this scary book every day? How does that feel?
It does feel scary sometimes. Like I've told other people that have asked me about this, you know, why did you make it so terrifying? Why are you so horrible? Well, it did scare me too, but in a delicious kind of way. Mm. You know, that scare that you do appreciate. I think there's a fine line, for example, between thriller and horror. So I'm not in the horror sphere, but I'm in that thriller sphere that we're drawn to for whatever reason. But quite often when I was writing The Rush, you can see the backdrop of my study here, the keyboard and the door quite some distance apart, and I often looked over my shoulder. I often felt creeped out, and that's when I knew that this was working.
Yes, it is something about that vibe. I was about to say that I often wanted to do that. It's not a don't run up the stairs vibe, but it's definite. No, don't do that, character. What are you doing? Don't do that. So well done on getting that feeling out of the reader. We're always really fascinated on the podcast to hear, especially how crime and thriller writers go about planning their books, because I don't do crime and thriller, so I'm not sure about how someone can write without knowing who done it, for instance, and talking to different people like Leanne Moriarty doesn't know who did it. Jane Harper starts with who did it. What's your process, Michelle Frack, for writing down your thriller?
I am a plotter.
Okay.
So I don't think I could finish a manuscript without plotting. And in fact, that's why I failed for so many years to complete a manuscript, because I didn't understand that approach. So I do plot it out and I know who the villains are and broadly what's going to happen. Every chapter has a plan and I start writing when I know the end. However, the end does change during the drafting process. And with The Rush in particular, I'm so glad I let it gestate and sit for a while I was doing other things, because the big so-called twist of The Rush didn't come to me until I'd been working on it for years. So it's plotting, but there still are lightning bolts and things that change.
That's really interesting, because it's such a great twist. But also, Michelle, I'm interested in you saying then about the fact that you think previous either versions or previous times you'd had a go at manuscripts, they'd failed because you didn't know about plotting. What have you learned then over this period of time of adjusting the manuscript and about plotting?
Yeah, I guess years ago as a novice writer, I didn't even know about the concepts of plotting versus pantsing and all the shades in between. So one of the big things I learned was it's okay to sit at the keyboard and Google how to write a novel, because a lot of people have published advice and you might find that approach that best suits you. But for me, that more romantic notion of sitting at a blank page and letting the muse come, that put me off a time and time again, and it scared me. I might, you know, with that approach, I'd finish perhaps 30% of a manuscript and then it would all fall over. So just discovering the plotting approach, yeah, really helped me, because it gives me the confidence to come to the screen and that I've got that roadmap ahead and there's less pressure every day. And it's not to say, as I mentioned, that I'll stick to that. There's a lot of creative bursts and new angles that come in, and you deepen characters as you get to understand them. But that's a big takeaway or a big learning curve that I had.
That's great. I love that movement away from the romance of the novelist with the blank page. I think there are so many extraordinary resources for us all to learn from that we should just be inhaling them as much
Absolutely.
As we can. Michelle, what I'm interested in also is that this is your first traditionally published novel, but it certainly isn't your first novel. And you've also been, as we said in your bio, in the writing world for the last 30 years in your other career in PR. Can you tell us a couple of the key things you've learned about writing that really makes a reader sit up and take notice over all your wordsmithing?
Okay. So for me as a reader, something that makes me sit up and take notice is when writing gets to the point. So I think there I'm reflecting that journalism background, and I'm also reflecting on all the government and corporate writing I've done over the years in terms of getting to the point in a media release, plain language, in a government briefing. And that's why I'm not writing literary novels, but I'm writing thrillers. So my approach is a more pared back style, where I don't weigh down scenes of dialogue, for example. I don't want to describe so much how someone might be scratching their nose. I just want the dialogue, and so it can fall into a more of a kind of a script. And so I like that approach. And not, I guess, waffling too much. To me, that hooks me. And of course, there has to be a balance, though, because if I kept up that approach too much, I would be turning in a book that had 30,000 words. But for me, I do appreciate that. And that's probably reflects my more pragmatic personality as well.
There's certainly nothing lost in the sense of place or tension or character in The Rush. So you've definitely nailed the sweet spot in there, Michelle. I'm interested in the difference of your experience between self-publishing those commercial women's fiction titles and traditional publishing, because we have a lot of listeners on the First Time podcast who are interested in self-publishing and the pros and cons of that. Can you give us the pros and cons from your perspective?
Definitely. So they're so vastly different, really, really different worlds, of course. I guess the massive pro of traditional publishing is that you have that team behind you, and they have decades of experience in most cases. And with self-publishing, on the other side of the coin, a benefit is that you're steering the ship, you're in charge, you're more independent. If you're like me and you have a comms background as well, you might actually enjoy being in charge of your PR and comms plan and how you represent yourself. You might enjoy doing everything from reaching out to book reviewers and bloggers to creating your own social media tiles. And so there can be a lot of enjoyment in feeling like you're in charge of your own destiny. That's a nice thing with self-publishing. But of course, the big downside is that it's extremely hard to compete against the publishing houses, the traditional publishing houses, with their massive reach and their expertise. But we know as well that there are authors that succeed in traditional and there's authors that succeed in self-publishing, and there's ones in both realms that don't reach the readership that they would have hoped.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell us about your own path to publication with a traditional publisher, Michelle? How did you get the deal? What happened?
Okay, terrific. I should have expected this question on the first time pod. I love these origin stories when I hear them. They're fantastic. So after I had self-published three books, I still had the dream of wanting to be traditionally published. I leaned on Writer's Essay for support, and they I paid for a manuscript assessment of The Rush, which gave me fantastic confidence that it was in good shape. Mm. And then I started pitching it to agents. I really was keen to have an agent hold my hand. Eventually came across the desk of Melanie Austell, who's absolutely amazing. And we worked on it together for a few months before, and she took over that pitching work and talked to a few publishers, and Simon and Schuster stood out as being the best home for me.
Oh, it's such a great story. And I love, like so many of our other guests, that you talk about going to your writer's center first, and also getting that professional feedback before you start doing the pitching. It seems like such an essential part of the journey for most people.
Agree.
Michelle, you mentioned just before about that joy of having some control, and with your comms background, of some of the self-publishing work. And I'm assuming that your PR and comms background allows you to feel some confidence in some of this part of the job that you're up to at the moment, which is publicizing and promoting your own book. Can you put on your PR hat and not your author hat for a moment and give us some advice about how you're approaching this period and what works, you think?
Yeah, absolutely. I heard you and Catherine recently discuss the differences between marketing and PR, so that was excellent to listen to, because I think that's already a confusing point for a lot of authors. When it comes to PR, a big difference with marketing is that PR can be something you can control a little more as an author, because the difference between PR and marketing is that in marketing you need a budget. You're paying for attention. You're buying space and merchandise and so on. But PR tends to be that discipline where you're not given much budget at all. You're expected to earn coverage, and it's all about relationships. So that's what I'm trying to leverage, and other authors can feel like they have that power in their hands as well. It's about positive relationships with the right people. So you can begin by mapping out the people that are important to you and your book, as well as your publisher. It'll be your ideal reader, book reviewers, book bloggers, the booksellers and stores, and so on. So from a PR perspective, an author can start to consider, how am I going to nurture a positive relationship with these really important audiences? How do I follow them, let them know who I am, and support them and their work? And finally, PR jargon, I'm sorry.
No, I love what's it.
What's your key message? We talk about elevator pitch a lot with books. It's similar to that in the PR world. What's your key message? What do you want to say about your book? And what's that phrase you're going to bang out again and again, so that you can perhaps cut through a lot of that noise, and people might remember a little gem about your book, and one day they can pick it up.
That's so useful, Michelle. And I have to say that when I knew that you had a book out, and I only know you as being a first-time podcast listener and someone who would share our work. I knew you as Pracky on Twitter. And when I saw that you had a book deal, there was a real excitement that, oh, here's someone who's been following the podcast for a long time who I'm really interested to talk to. So I suppose that gives our listeners an example of how you are doing kind of long-term nourishing of relationships within the book community at a time when you didn't even know that this was ahead of you.
Absolutely. I'm so glad you used that phrase long-term, because that is PR as well. It is long-term. Mm. Absolutely.
Can you give us or share with us the best advice that you can share with our listeners on writing, either advice that you've been given or advice that you have passed on to other people as well?
Yes, absolutely. I think I can come back to what I've said about plotting. So my advice is to find that method that best suits you. And it can mean a lot of research or leaning on your local writers' organisation or talking to other authors. You know, we all have a different approach. And if you're struggling, it may be that the method that you're using isn't the one for you. So go and research. Don't be afraid to pop in those noob questions on Google, because there's someone out there who's using a method and that will be perfect for you.
Michelle, can you recommend to us a debut book, anytime, any genre?
Absolutely. And I've got props. So it's not a thriller. And this was big a long time ago. So I read Eleanor Oliphant Is Completely Fine. I wish that title came off the tongue more easily. By Gail Honeyman. I read that in 2019 around its publication time. It's hard to describe the genre, but it's such a heartwarming and gorgeous story that has a mystery underlining it. And I was really moved by that. A lot of the themes were around loneliness as well, which wasn't a massive discussion at the time. And the main character has a problematic mother, which really resonated with me.
Perfect. We'll leave it right there on that. But that's a great, I think we call it uplit. I think it's that, yes. Like, yeah,
true.
Uplit. Is what we call it. Eleanor Oliphant Is Completely Fine. Michelle, I'm speaking to you just before the release of your book. Our listeners don't get to hear this episode until your book will have been out on the shelves for a couple of weeks. How are you feeling right now?
I'm feeling both excited and calm. It's a funny sort of medium spot to be in. You know, there was a lot of exciting, jolting moments over the publishing journey. But now it's more calm. I feel prepared, and my head and a lot of my time is immersed in the second thriller that I'm working on now. So, yeah, it's a nice space to be in. It's great.
Oh, that's a really exciting time to be able to throw forward into that creative energy at such a big time. Michelle, where can people find you to hear you talking about your book once it's out?
They can find me online at michellepracky.com. As you mentioned, I'm called Pracky across a lot of social media, and that's because there were so many other Michelles in class when I was growing up. We had to get nicknames.
I know the feeling as a kid.
Yeah, I bet you do. And then I've got a few Sisters in Crime events coming up in Adelaide on 31st of May and in Melbourne on the 23rd of June, which I'm looking forward to.
Fantastic. And we will put links to those events in our show notes. Michelle Pratt, congratulations and enjoy the roller coaster to come. We hope that lots of readers find The Rush. I really loved it.
Thanks so much. Thank you, Kate.
Okay, one I'm only going to mention quickly because you have mentioned it also, but I really wanted to give my double endorsement to it too. So it's Cautionary Tales for Excitable Girls by Anne Casey Hardy. Before the featured book interview, you were talking about being jealous of Maggie McKellar's sentences. I read this book and just want to steal every word, and just it reminds me a lot of Miranda July, who I absolutely, absolutely adore. So Anne Casey Hardy's Cautionary Tales for Excitable Girls. Yeah, I would scribble out her name and very happily put my own. If I reckon if you could pick the style of writing, I don't think you get to pick the style of writing that you have, but if I could, that is what I would, that's what I would.
I praise indeed, Colette. What have you been listening to?
Okay, so Listen is linked with something I've said previously, the Publishing Rodeo podcast.
Oh, yes.
It is a, another one about money, our favourite topic.
Our favourite topic. Keeps on giving.
Big wigs. Okay, so the hosts of the podcast are Sunyi Dean and Scott Drakeford. They have a guest that comes on the podcast whose name is Andrea Stewart, and the whole episode is about finances as a full-time author and basically how they make it work. Yeah, so Sunyi and Andrea both got big advances, so ballpark, and they say how much, 250 to 300,000 US for their books.
Quite a lot.
Quite a good advance. I think Andrea's was for three books.
Okay.
So 100,000 per book. Yeah. Scott's was 30,000 for three books, so a smaller advance, yeah, but still, you know, pretty good.
Yeah.
But the most interesting thing about this discussion is they talk about partner support. And I think this is something we've mentioned previously. We've certainly spoken about it between the two of us. Super awkward to talk about, but they're really, really candid. So both Scott and Andrea, you know, Andrea, who's had a, you know, fairly sizable advance, able to write full time because of the financial support of their partners. And that's both around stable, regular income, because publishing, the payment system is very ad hoc.
Yeah.
And then the other part to that is just the level of income. Sunyi's situation is a little bit different. She's separated. She has a child that has particular needs. But they have this lovely way of just acknowledging partner support and talking to the pros and cons of it. It's a discussion that is familiar in some ways, particularly if you are a woman and has had kids or have friends in that situation and have given up work or worked significantly less for long periods of time. Often that is a gendered thing. I have not heard it discussed in the way that these guys discuss it, and definitely not in the arts space. And so they kind of talk to the pro of partner support is that you can write, but the con of that is if things go wrong. And so Sunyi is a kind of a case study maybe in things having gone wrong. Very, very thought-provoking, sobering in the sense that even for, you know, experiences of the experience of people who are fairly high income earners, that partner support is often still necessary.
Mm.
But it also made me think about, we focus so much in terms of the discussion on of diversity, on cultural diversity, gender diversity, obviously super, super important, but that economic view of diversity also absent really within the writing world in many ways, and what an advantage it can be to be partnered, even where you are not having financial support of a partner, but, you know, things like caregiving. I think of my own situation. I work nearly full time, but I can go to McDonald's at 5 o'clock in the morning because someone else is at home. Yeah. So single parents is one type of experience within that bucket.
So huge. And this, I've been having this conversation with a few people recently, also about this idea of women's super in creative, you know, industries, and exactly that there is no way to catch it if you do become unpartnered, or if you always were, or if you've got no other support. How do you keep on? How do you?
And
keep
there's
on
a host of other
doing your art,
you know, chronic illness and disability and all these kinds of things too.
Absolutely.
Yeah. It made me think of the James and Ashley Stay at Home podcast by James McKenzie Watson and Ashley Collation Blunt, which is about writing and health, essentially.
Yeah.
That kind of talks in some ways to some of those ideas too.
Do you know what I want to find out about? This was part of the conversation I was having. There is, I think, something called the Actors Benevolent Fund or something like that. I know that contributed to it during COVID. And I don't know that there's something similar for writers, and then it would be an extraordinary thing if we were able to, when we're in a position to put away some funds or to contribute to a fund that other writers could access when shit hits the fan. I think, you know, that would be part of a really good way to keep supporting the industry.
It's a little bit like in, I mean, it doesn't exist, but in a lot of businesses and government orgs, you have an allocation of sick leave, but you can actually donate your sick leave.
Yes.
You know, a week, a year or something to a sick leave bank that can then be accessed by people if they need it. But yeah, I don't know what that looks like in the art space. One of the things that this Scott Drakeford talks to is this idea of writing and publishing really being set up as a gig economy and that, you know, you have a contract for one thing, but there's no stability or no security beyond that particular contract.
Yeah, absolutely. I've just taken leave from the PhD for a bit because I couldn't meet the next milestone because it's kind of in the middle of publication stuff. And that has been my primary source of income other than my partner income for the last year and a half. And the delight of knowing something that turns up in your bank account every fortnight and now not having that is it's frightening. frightening, but like I do have partner support.
Thinking about the level of work to do the Toastmasters speech, which was unpaid, they paid for flights and accommodation, but that's a lot of time.
It's a lot of time.
Like if I was trying to cost that, I mean, you could never really cost it around the actual, I mean, you would get better at it too and all those kinds of things. But it's not the best investment of time to earnings ratio, that's for sure.
We will keep awkwardly thinking, referencing, talking about money and trying to come up with solutions for, I mean, we could do it for the end of time, couldn't we?
We could. The on the topic of awkward conversations, I did like this structure of theirs around pros and cons because it makes it feel a little bit more, you're a bit removed. It's a bit more sort of objective. We have talked previously between us about doing an awkward conversation about writers groups and the, you know, what works and what doesn't work. So just putting a call out to people, if you have thoughts or comments or anecdotes about writers groups, maybe that's a way for us to approach it, send them through
via
our website. That'd be great.
One watching that I have done, I don't know if you got a chance to see it, but of course, after our, my career highlight interview with Tim Winton, Ningaloo came out
this week.
But we watched the first episode of the documentary and it's just brilliant. It's so good. There's lots that he talked about when I went to see him in Castlemaine as well as on the
interview. So how did that happen?
How did we get the
Castlemaine visit?
Oh, Castlemaine, that's Northern Books had Tim in the Castlemaine Theatre. He was interviewed by Sophie Cunningham.
Oh, beautiful. Amazing.
Kristen was delightful. And I went with our lovely Jill and she had saved us front row seats, which was very exciting. Kristen was very helpful in helping us to secure that interview with Tim, which was terrific.
That's nice.
But just some of the talking about what goes on behind the show. So he talked about that a bit in our interview about just how incredibly hard it was to write that narration because it's so few words. But it has got this incredible Winton kind of quality to it. But also the fact that they were very, they had really decided what they wanted the series to be about. So there's some things, I don't think it wasn't in the first episode, it must be in the second or the third, where there's a coral bloom. And then the coral bloom kind of goes pear-shaped and the winds don't come and everything dies. He was talking about this in Castlemaine. And a woman from the BBC who was on the production team said, if this was a BBC production, you wouldn't be able to put that part in because it needs to be, you know, kind of people don't want to see dying coral, but they put it in. Yeah, so just really encouraging.
Well, I can't wait for that. That's my Saturday run.
Excellent.
Reserved for that key time slot.
Any reality TV you've been watching, Catherine?
No, I've really cut back. I've been not so busy between Sydney. I think if you go away, I've used up many partner credits in the going away, but I just have come back to a mountain of work. So sadly.
Well, go and get back.
But it will all be there waiting for me. So once I get through this a little bit, I'll be,
And let's
although I have been watching Lego Masters with the kids.
Oh, nice. Very good.
Which is fun. Yeah.
Very good.
Very wholesome.
One more time, congratulations to you, my friend, on your amazing news and new book deal. I cannot wait to follow that.
You can find the show notes for today's episode on our website, thefirsttimepodcast.com. Get in touch with us via Instagram or Twitter at @thefirsttimepod, or you can leave us a message on the website. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to The First Time Podcast. We record this podcast virtually on the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to elders, past and present, and we extend that to our First Nations guests and listeners. Sound production by Phoebe 80, who we can employ because of the wonderful support of our patrons via Patreon. Thank you so much for making this podcast possible.